There are clear physical changes due to climate warming. What about biological changes? And what can we expect? Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The Marine Science Symposium gathering is underway. And we'll tell you what we are seeing. But Alaskans, what are you seeing? 1-800-478-TALK. To join us toll-free, it's a local call in Anchorage. An email is talk@alaskapublic.org. We've got two people that have been participating in the Marine Science Symposium to open the show.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Your household income and the size of your family might qualify you for savings on your health care costs. You have until Sunday, January 31st, to enroll in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Call 1-844-PLANS-AK. That's 1-844-752-6725 to find local assistance in your area. There's more information online at getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
I doubt that either one of my guests would agree with me when I say that there has been a comparative avalanche of funding for research in high latitudes, and that yields then a bunch of data. It doesn't necessarily yield insight, but it yields data, and you have to try and figure the data out. I'm sure any scientist would like to see more funding, but nonetheless, it certainly has been on the increase. With me today are two really distinguished panelists and also people who are extremely familiar with Talk of Alaska because they've been listening to it and they've been helping me with the show, not only with their questions, but with their insights. And so I guess I'd like to first welcome Bruce Wright, the senior scientist for the Aleutian-Pribilof Islands Association. Welcome to Talk Alaska, Bruce.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
I had you on about wolves, I believe, one time. Predators, a more general subject of predators anyway.
Right. You said you couldn't get anybody else to do it.
But you stepped forward. That's good. You stepped up.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of wolves.
And now you've stepped up again.
I think this is actually a little more interesting because it affects a lot more people.
Yeah. So the symposium is clustered with a bunch of other scientific meetings, because everybody's in town, so they have all these other meetings. So you were going to one of those yesterday, Bruce, about the unusual mortality events or unexplained mortality events.
Right, the unusual mortality event.
And we have not just the seabirds that everybody has been talking about, but we have those fin whales a while back as well, and could be others, I suppose.
I think it was unusual for a lot of factors. One is there was the blob. I think a lot of people have heard about the warm water blob. That looks like it was a precursor to a huge algae bloom. And the algaes that bloomed are one called Pseudonychia. It's a single-cell diatom. The other one is called Alexandrium, and it's a single-cell plant also, and it's a dinoflagellate. And the bloom was extensive, and we hadn't seen that much Pseudonychia in Alaska before. We haven't measured it to those levels.
I didn't know we'd seen any, Bruce.
Yeah, we had. Ray Roland and I did a study in 2009. We predicted that eventually we would get blooms of Pseudonychia up here. So in 2009, we did a Gulf of Alaska-wide study for that whole summer and fall. And we found the organism, but we didn't find significant levels of the organism. But that was a cold year. And this year, the Gulf of Alaska warmed up several degrees. And that has allowed the organism to do well. The other thing that allowed the organism to do well was, according to the oceanographer, there was stable air mass, and so the oceans weren't mixing very much. And the nutrient level dropped. This is like a perfect storm for Pseudonychia. The nutrient level drops. The warmer water promoted Pseudonychia, and it precipitated, grew all the way up into the Bering Sea. We'd never seen anything like that.
Wow, yeah. So right across the Alaska Peninsula and on up.
All the way up, yeah, yeah.
You, man, I got so many different directions. But I guess just to clarify background, the pseudo-Nietzsche, that's the one that was involved with the huge and lengthy Dungeness crab closure?
Pseudo-Nietzsche levels off of the coast of California and Oregon. It looks like the warm there was a warm mass of water off the coast of California and Oregon as well. And that looked like it grew, the organism grew mostly offshore. Then they had onshore winds that concentrated the organism close to shore. And the toxin that organism makes is called domoic acid. So the toxin levels were extremely high onshore along the coast of California, Oregon, a little bit of Washington. And they had these huge Dungeness crab closures, closures of forage fish. And I think a lot of people have heard about the sea lions that succumbed down in California, succumbed to domoic acid poisoning.
Wow. So we're, I'm going to be flipping around and changing the subject a whole lot. But I want to go a little bit further pursuing this particular issue of the waterborne pathogens and the changing currents and so forth and what we might see in the future. Because it appeared to me, Bruce, that, and I think you would agree, Alaska is not really well positioned for a quick response to as these things change, as they are likely to do.
We weren't organized when this happened last year, in that we weren't prepared to go out and collect samples for this whole region. We didn't predict that big of a pseudo-Nietzsche bloom, or maybe that aggressive.
I don't think anybody would. I mean, you say that you had indications, but that's not quite a prediction.
Right, and so we weren't prepared. Nonetheless, several NOAA organizations put together cruises and collected a bunch of data. They arrived a little bit towards the end of the bloom. They're doing a bunch of studies out of Lower Cook Inlet, Ketchumack Bay, mostly driven by Fish and Game, NOAA, and the university. And as this thing developed, a bunch of scientists stepped up and started collecting samples and talking to people about what they were seeing, so collecting observations. I was surprised at the presentation yesterday, because oceanographers, ecologists, and people studying harmful algal blooms collected a bunch of data, and they tried to pull it together yesterday to paint this picture of what happened. And it sounds like this is a phrase that's used too much, but a perfect storm for harmful algal blooms last summer.
Mm-hmm. And what would you recommend? I mean, basically, you, I know, have a PSP monitoring program in place, for instance.
That's correct.
That's largely your work.
and that's kind of small. I have a couple of sites in southeast Alaska, and then a few sites along the Aleutian Islands, Alaska Peninsula. That's really not enough to capture the intensity and timing of these things and to make good predictions. There's a really nice intensive program in Ketchumack Bay, a bunch of partners there. And then there's the British Columbia has their programs, and we're trying to coordinate those. And then Washington, Oregon, they have state programs, and then the federal government programs, mostly NOAA-driven. So they're... As I was listening to all of this, I surmised that if we had 10 times the level of support out there and resources, that we could answer the questions that we have, such as what happened to those whales? Why are these birds starving and washing up on the beach? We've got some hypotheses, but we don't have enough data to support them.
Well, that's peanuts, 10 times?
It really is, you know. It really is. We should be able to step up to bat, and if we had the resources and answer these questions, we could do that. And now we're talking about 2016, because of the El Nino, we may see continued warming in the Gulf of Alaska. So if we see continued warming in the Gulf of Alaska, I predict that we'll have another big pseudo-Nietzsche and PSP blooms.
Well, the oceanographer yesterday in the keynote speech said we got a bit of a blob there, but it's not as big of a blob as it had been.
But he said it's deeper. It's still deep. Now, that's what was interesting with this blob, is that when it first developed, it was shallow, mm-hmm. 70 meters. And then as the summer progressed, it moved down to several, I guess, 200 or 300 meters, I think you said.
Yeah.
And he says that that is still kind of persisting. Not as warm as it was, but it's still pretty warm out there.
Now, I noticed that he wouldn't use the word teleconnection to, even though when you saw them in sequence, you see the blob in the Gulf of Alaska, and then you see it off of the coast of California, and it just, to me, it looked like the same blob. But he wouldn't say that. He wouldn't say that it moved south and then it strengthened El Nino.
Yeah, and that's not what happened. It looks like it was driven by a weather pattern, high pressure that kind of moved the low pressure off and allowed for low wind events and just this warming.
Mm-hmm.
So the blob is actually patchy. Off of Southern California, there was an area, and then I think off of Oregon, and then in the Gulf of Alaska. So it was patchy. I don't think it telecommunicated. I don't think it progressed from Southern California up. I think it was just this whole weather event that was kind of driving this thing.
Hmm.
I don't know that anybody could have predicted that.
Yeah. We're talking to Bruce Wright. He's with the senior scientist with the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, and I don't mean to close you out of the conversation here on Talk of Alaska. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. An email is talk@alaskapublic.org. Yesterday's keynote addresses to kind of kick the thing off and set the theme featured a longtime listener to Talk of Alaska. And one of the reasons he's a longtime listener is because it's kind of nice to have something to listen to on the radio when you're on an island all summer long with some birds up in the water up north of Barrow. George Dvoke, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. It's great to be here.
Well, you've been following the same, famously now, following this same colony of black guillemots. And it turns out that you have a very long time series. And when you combine the time series, as you were doing yesterday, with other factors, the environmental factors, you keep turning up new information from this bunch of birds that you've been watching all these years.
Yes, and it's a bunch of birds that I started studying in 1975 just because I wanted to study birds, and then climate change came in and said, okay, what about us? And then I had to see what the birds were doing in response to that. So it is now something that I can't look away from because I don't know what's going to happen next year. Because if I'd been a modeler based on my first 10 years of data and said this was going to happen, I would have never have predicted that I would have seen the things I've seen in the last 40 years.
Now, there was one point where things got so bad, George, that you only had one successful breeding?
Yes.
You had how many birds all together who come to this island and then try to breed?
Oh, there are about 400 black guillemots that come to the island or came to the island in the early 1990s. The population is now down to 200 birds. And one of the reasons it's down is because as the ice started to retreat rather rapidly in the 1990s, three things happened. One is that the primary prey of black guillemots, Arctic cod, which like cold water and like being under ice, moved offshore as the ice moved offshore and the waters got warmer. And as the ice pulled offshore, horned puffins came up from the Bering Sea and started prospecting the same nest cavities the guillemots were breeding in and started to push eggs out of nest sites and kill chicks. And then as the ice was retreating, the polar bears left the ice and came swimming into Cooper Island, where there was nothing to eat except guillemot chicks. So in 2009, we had roughly 180 guillemot chicks hatch. And it was a race to see who was going to kill more, the puffins or the polar bears. But we ended up with one chick that fledged that year, and that was a direct result of climate change. Birds were starving in nest sites. Birds were being eaten by polar bears. Birds were being killed by prospecting puffins. None of those things had happened in the previous 35 years.
And yet, your colony is still hanging in there with some human intervention. I mean, it's almost reminding me, George, of a zoo. I mean, it's very remote, or maybe more like a zoological park kind of situation. But I mean, you've had to build special houses for these birds now.
Right. Well,
otherwise, the polar bears would have done away with them by now.
No, they would. And also, I had to build a special house for myself, or the polar bears would have done away
so,
with
yeah.
me too. So, in 1975, all of the nest sites that I found were in boxes left by the Navy in the 1950s, and then I then built more boxes from the wood that the Navy had left, and did that for the next 35 years or so. But then when the bears came in, they could easily flip these boxes over. So I realized after 2009, with the one chick that was able to leave that year, that I had to do something. So I bought some pelican cases, or heavy-duty plastic cases, drilled a hole in one end, put them out where guillemots had bred the previous year, and the guillemots bred in those sites. Polar bears came up to them that summer and couldn't get the chicks. So I thought, if I'm going to keep the study going, I have to basically replace all 200 nest sites with these plastic cases. So I bought Nanook cases, which is a very nice plastic case made in Canada, and I replaced every nest site, and the colony now has 200 black plastic cases. So it is a strange-looking bird colony in that it looks like a bunch of birds are breeding in suitcases, because that's essentially what it is.
And you've gone 40 years with this, 41, 42?
42. This is the start of the 42nd year. I did my 41st field season last summer. Again, it
was... Some people would say you're crazy, George.
Well, actually, and I think, and you know what? And since some people do, that's why I stay on the island for 3 months, so I can't hear them say that.
Right.
I listen to Talk of Alaska when I'm on the island, but people can't send me emails or things. Yes, there was a component of getting involved in this, and having started my work up here in 1970, when Earth Day was going on, and being a product of the 60s and 70s, it was a different sort of career trajectory that I saw. Like, wait a minute, this could be something that could be very interesting for a very long term study. And one of the main things that happened is I started banding birds. And those years when I was thinking about not going out, I thought, what's going to happen to this bird that's bred in this nest site for the past 10 years? And so I had to go back and check on these birds, and they all have color bands. So like white, orange, gray, which was this long-term bird that I'd been following, I thought, if I don't go up, no one's going to know what happened to white, orange, gray. So and these were the constants in my life at that point. So I would go back because it was the one constant I had. And certainly the people of Barrow let me do this, because I would show up, and if I had trouble getting out to the island or getting support, the North Slope Bureau and the people of Barrow helped me greatly. So that was a very, very important part of keeping the study going.
And we're talking legitimate scientific data here. I mean, this is not like, you know, George's zoo or George's hobby or anything like that. I mean, this is actual, genuine scientific work. You are making many measurements on these birds, right?
We actually measure almost everything we can easily for the birds. We certainly know when they're laying the first egg. We frequently get there when they first arrive on the island. And then when they start laying eggs, we check every nest site every day until breeding is complete. And we then measure the eggs. We then get the timing of incubation, because we see when the chicks hatch. We get daily growth rates of the chicks for 35 days. We get adult survival, because as I said, we're banding birds. We see who bred last year, who didn't come back the next year. We get prey being brought to the chicks over the 35-day nestling period, and we were just monitoring all of that, because that's what you do if you study birds. And then as the climate changed, all those variables started to change.
Okay, I'm going to put out the phone number again. We're talking with George Devoke. He's a bird researcher, obviously. He works on Cooper Island, and he has an organization called Friends of Cooper Island. If you want to get involved, they have a website and so forth. And he's not all by himself on that island every summer anymore, but he's been doing it for 41 and says now that he's going to be back again this year. So that'll be 42 years, and has no intention I can see of stopping. And the longer, what is the value of a time series? And the telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org, and we'll go to the calls in just a moment. But what is the value of a long-time series? And how come there aren't so many, aren't a lot more of them?
Well, as I was getting ready to give my talk yesterday, and it's only recently that I realized 42 years is a long time. It was just something I was doing. I mean, I think it's probably like being happily married where you suddenly realize, gee, I've been married for 40 years, and it didn't seem like a long haul.
If it's or being radio for 56.
You know, one thing that I thought of, and that is not mentioned by people who are doing 2 or 3 year studies on anything, is that if you really want to know something about a place, you gather a long time series, which is what the National Weather Service does. The National Weather Service doesn't go to a place, gather data for 10 years, say, okay, we have some baseline data, let's go somewhere else because there's more funding there now. They know that if they're going to say anything about a certain month or a certain time period, they have to be gathering, in their case, daily and sometimes hourly observations. And it's clear to me, because people have said, well, couldn't you basically model those years? And I probably could model rather well now what would happen, so I could do every other year. But you don't find the National Weather Service saying, oh, by the way, we don't need to really monitor Barrow weather next year because we kind of know what's happened in the past. And especially now with climate change, you can't have models that will be something that will really tell you what's going on, because we don't know what's going to happen with the climate next year.
Yeah, I think that is the key of it, that things are changing, and the changes then they ping pong down into out of the physical system into the biological system, and then throughout the ecosystem, and there's tipping points all the way along the chain there. There's feedbacks and tipping points that suddenly change things to something different.
So Steve, the long-term data set then that George describes, he's seen several tipping points.
Yeah.
I mean, he's seen those. Yes. You know, one is the bears coming in. The other is the puffins coming in. The other is the loss of the sea ice, and so their primary food. That's the benefit of this long-term data. And he follows standard bird monitoring protocols, nesting site protocols, so it's comparable across other bird colonies.
Well, let's see what the callers are saying out there, or questions they might have, or more information. Let's go to New Stoyahawk. And Anna, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Anna.
Good morning, Chamai. Welcome.
And Chamai,
thanks for letting me have this opportunity to ask my curious questions as usual. I had a question. What's that big word, meta something? What's that big word you're using for the birds and
mortality, dying? Unusual mortality event. Is that it? Unusual mortality event?
Unusual mortality event. Okay, I went to how to save energy class, and I went to a gardening class, and now I'm going to a bird class. And with all these problems we're having statewide, you know, instead of sitting around here like other, you know, some of my friends or kids that graduate from high school and just stay home and, you know, I want to do something for Alaskans and other people in other countries. I love meeting other people. And, you know, I'm a hunter. I used to hunt and kill animals and mammals. I never hunt for a long time. And I used to catch birds back in the days in the 80s and lick some gall and put what they call that yarn on their pile of yarn, see if I could catch it again. That's what I used to do back when I was a little girl.
It makes all kinds of sense, Anna. I mean, scientifically.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I had a question with this, all these animals and mammals dying in different countries with the pebble mine. We don't want the pebble mine to go through. And what I heard with the people, I feel sorry for those people in other countries that are dying from water, and it, you know, it hurts me to hear that, because I'm lucky to, I always tell people I'm so lucky to have a home and good running water when there's other people out there when I play with water that are dying from that water because of the whatever's inside the water. So, anyway, that's all I have for now. If you have any questions or whatever, What do you think of? I don't know. My first time I'm on.
Hi, it's great to hear from New Stoyhuk, Anna. What's the weather like today?
Oh, it's beautiful. Slippery outside, but it's not flooding. Anyway, warm in here. I wish more of our communities in all over Bristol Bay could join that class. You know, it's good education, and you know, get up and do something for the country. You know, at least. But I'm hanging in there. I'm having a hard time, but not that much of a hard time as some other people. So, anyway, hopefully everybody. I have nothing else.
Okay.
But just be careful out there. And I'm going to join that bird class in February, so I have all the questions to ask all the questions I can.
Okay, well, sounds like you come up with some pretty good ones. Thanks, Anna. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, too.
Yeah. Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. So she puts yarn on the birds to see if they came back.
So she
makes all kinds of sense.
She was doing a little science investigation using a tracking technique, right?
Yeah. And that's perfectly legit. This one comes from Kevin. A year ago, we heard a lot about sea stars that were being killed off by a virus that killed off all species of mature sea stars. That might be an overstatement. But can we get an update on this die-off? Can you tell me anything about that, Bruce Wright?
I think he's referring to the wasting disease,
yeah.
The sea star wasting disease.
That's a virus, right?
And I think so. Uh-huh. And I believe that there's been a few examples of that on Alaska sea stars.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard of huge die-offs in Alaska yet from that event.
Okay. Anything you heard, George?
No.
You're an Arctic guy.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I don't see sea stars up there.
Yeah, I don't see them up there, but, you know, you might.
That's right. That might be the next thing that hits Cooper Island, well, are sea stars.
But, yeah, the plankton's changing. We know the plankton's changing now up there, and mm-hmm. The composition of marine mammals is changing. The fish probably changed. And you were saying your birds, for instance, were getting caught and then switched to sculpin.
Yes.
And that's an ice dependency kind of situation, most likely, right?
Yeah. And actually, one of the things that sea stars and other things in the Beaufort Sea, one didn't in the past, at least, have much of a benthic of a bottom fauna because we had these very deep keels on the ice that were scraping things up so much. Now, with the ice volume changing as much as it is, there is a chance for lots of species that do want to occupy the bottom to be there and not be disturbed by ice events.
I didn't even think of that scraping as a biological force, but of course it would be. A pure physical force, you're right.
Right. We didn't predict that, did we?
No, and actually, because of the fact that guillemots elsewhere feed on bottom fish, what may well happen is that good bottom fish, not like sculpin, will come up, and that's what the guillemots can switch to at some point. But
how do they even see them?
I'm sorry?
How do they detect them down there, all the way down to the bottom?
Well, I mean, they're only going roughly to 20 meters, and this is a species of bird that winters at Barrow. Some birds winter at Barrow, so they have very good night vision.
Uh-huh. Tough little devils, aren't they?
Yeah. but that whole thing with the ice scour was amazing. On my first cruise, the people doing the bottom geology couldn't figure out what all of these lines and scrapes were. They thought it was walrus tusks. Uh-huh. And then they realized, no, because we had these ones that went quite some distance as a keel of ice moved through the Chukchi. And then, because they were then concerned about subsea permafrost and pipelines, they were very interested in just how deep these keels might go.
Right. And it's still an issue.
Well, it's still an issue, sure. Yeah.
Let's go to Doug, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Doug.
Yeah, good morning. Good show. Enjoying this. Hey, I wanted to ask your guests about, well, back in, I think it was 98, 99, there was a big coccolithophore bloom out in the Bering Sea that resulted in a lot of bird deaths. There were windrows 3 foot deep of dead birds and some other sea animals on Nunavak Island. And I think it ended up being part of the cause of low returns of salmon to the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers a couple years later. And so I'm just wondering if your guests could talk about what they're seeing this year with the warm water and the bird die-offs in context with what happened back in there in 98, 99.
That may be a little wide-ranging for this panel. We'll see what we can do here, Doug.
Well, actually, Steve, yesterday one of the biologists said that there was a coccolithophore bloom again in the Bering Sea, and I think he said there was an impact on birds.
Hmm.
We were focused mostly on the Gulf of Alaska. Our
and
work.
You're talking what, last year or year before?
No, 2015.
Okay.
Just this last summer.
Yeah, because there was one in 14 also.
And there was one in 14 also.
Yeah.
So they're becoming more prevalent. When did we have that first one? 2000 or somewhere around there?
98, 99.
And
in 2000, 2001 is when we saw the big drop off. Maybe 2000 as well. But in 2001, 2002 is when we had huge drop offs of salmon population.
And that would be like from the pasturing, you're thinking, or?
Yeah, it had to do with the early marine period when the salmon were out and the coccolithophores, they couldn't eat them and the other fish were gone out of the water column. And so that, and during that early marine phase of the salmon life history, they just had poor survival and
so
few adults returning. But again, we had those huge windrows in that, I guess maybe it was 98 or 99, 2000, but we had those huge windrows of dead birds all along Nunavak Island, and the Fish and Wildlife Service out there in Bethel had sent crews out there to sample those birds, and they had all starved, much like what we're hearing now with the guillemots and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I know that we need to take our half-hour break here, but I know that as for MERS, I'm not going to speak to that, but I do know that shearwaters suffered a substantial mortality two summers ago in the Bering Sea that somebody doing a biological transect saw, and it was probably related to the coccolithophore bloom because it just impeded the visibility. They couldn't see their prey, and so they started because they couldn't find anything to eat. And as for the salmon, my God, that's just way scary, Doug. Just way scary.
We're just seeing some light at the end of the tunnel here now in the Yukon and Kuskokwim, so it is scary.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your call.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And we got a lot of lines full. We have a great panel, and we'll be running out of time before you know it. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
It's Talk of Alaska, and it's Frontier Science, and we are at the frontier of science here in Alaska. The Marine Science Symposium has grown every year, and it's truly massive this year. I mean, in a way, I'm kind of glad that there was so much interference with travel in the lower 48 that prevented some stuff from getting up here, because we have more research than anyone could possibly absorb, and I'm busily comparing notes even when we're taking the breaks with the two scientists that are with me. George DeVoki, who is a black guillemot researcher from Cooper Island. His organization is called Friends of Cooper Island, and he has an incredibly lengthy time series on the biology of these birds and how the environmental changes have affected the birds. It's through these things that we pick up the signals that nature is putting out. And we have Bruce Wright of the, he's the chief scientist of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. And we have just tons and tons of calls. I think we better get this one. Monique in Knik, I know you've been holding for a long time. Thank you for calling Talk of Alaska. It's your turn now.
Not too long, Steve, and thank you. There's the massive methane leak in Southern California that hasn't been covered that much. But at the same time, it's also been referred to as a disaster as large as the BP spill in the Gulf. I was wondering if your guests have any comments or thoughts or inside baseball on what's going on with that. Thank you.
What about the geology of Southern California? Or
there's a massive methane leak there.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I totally know about that. It's really basically almost a disaster. Yeah.
I'm wondering if that your guests have any thoughts.
Oh, okay.
How that would impact us or anything about it at all.
Methane leaks?
Media coverage.
There is media coverage on it.
Sure.
I will say that. And when you're in the media and you do a story, you sort of don't want to do the same story over and over again. It's very difficult, even though some people may not have heard it. But I don't think it's like being covered up or anything like that. It is kind of astounding that it's taking them so long to do anything about it. And you wonder if maybe if they spent more money, they'd be able to do more about it. Any comments, Bruce Wright?
Only that it adds more greenhouse gas to the environment.
Yeah.
And that's too bad.
All right. And just to say that one of the things, having started the study of birds, but then realizing that atmospherics were changing sea ice, so I then had to know much more about sea ice and then about atmospherics and then now about all sorts of things like methane in the atmosphere. People do ask me about those things, whereas no one ever goes to a methane person and ask them about seabirds. So it's like but like if I'm looking at the drivers of what's changing guillemots, I have to think about what are these ultimate drivers are.
Yeah. Do you have the nightmare about the methane hydrates that are underneath the ocean and suddenly popping up, burping themselves up, and totally turning off the meridional overturning and causing eco-catastrophe, killing the Gulf Stream and so forth? Like,
jeez, Steve.
I'm sorry. I'm just passing on the nightmare scenarios people are sending me.
When I see the data coming out about how much is coming out of the permafrost that is melting,
yeah,
and tundra that is now giving up methane, I think about that a lot because Cooper Island used to have permafrost right up almost to the surface. I couldn't pitch a tent in 75 because the active layer was that thin.
Now you wouldn't want to pitch a tent because a polar bear would get you.
No, exactly. And also now all the permafrost used to be there that I used to keep my cheese and various things in is gone. So when people talk about melting permafrost, I mean, I see on this one little sliver of an island how much has melted. And when I think about the whole Arctic and the fact that no matter that you can't have a conference in Paris that's going to stop that, you know, that permafrost is there from the last glacial maximum and it's going to stay unfrozen until the next glaciation.
Oy. Yeah, well, thanks for the call on methane. And obviously, it's a whole other show. Johnny joins the program from Hooper Bay. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Johnny.
Thank you. How's your day?
Pretty good.
One thing I wanted to cross is, you know, I started fishing for a halibut when we started looking for the halibut for the coastal villages. So, you know, fun, but anyways, since that time, I always check the stomachs for the halibut. And very unusually, I found some eels that usually migrate up the Yukon in the fall and are one of the two. And that's very unusual to see eels, like full-grown eels inside of the stomachs of those halibut last summer.
Well, Johnny, that's a very sort of thing that I was really hoping that people would call up and talk about, things that you personally are observing there. So this Hooper Bay would be the Yukon River Delta, where it hits the Bering Sea, and you're saying that there's eels that come up there, but you'd never seen the eels in the halibut stomachs before?
Yes. Ever since we found out that there were halibut up there, and, you know, I would find, like, flatfish, crabs, and all sorts of other little fish in there, but It was very unusual last summer to find like full-grown eels inside the halibut. And I just wanted to let you guys know.
Yes.
Back maybe like five to 8 years ago, I found like where, you know, where the salmon, usually the baby salmon that go out into the ocean. Where I usually check them out, I haven't found them like in the past couple of years too. I usually check on them when I head out into the deep waters.
Johnny, thank you. Thank you for those observations.
Actually, there's been a number of studies on fish diets, just looking at fish stomachs. There was a great one done about a decade ago in Lower Cook Inlet. The graduate student was collecting stomachs from the charter fleet and then analyzing them every day. And sometimes you would get a species shift of what they were eating from the little decorator crab, and then the next day they might be eating forage fish. And it was these rapid changes. And the fishermen could be fishing in the exact same spot. So long-term studies of fish diets, they can be very revealing of these shifts, these species composition changes, and it might just be something that happens from week to week. Mm-hmm. But over the long term, I mean, if you looked at fish stomachs where George is doing his study near shore, you might also see the same thing that he saw with the guillemots, and that is Arctic cod to sculpin.
Yeah. Johnny, I want to thank you very much for that call. It's Talk of Alaska, and Stu joins the program from Muldoon. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stu.
Welcome back, Steve.
Thank you.
Question about common loons in South Central. My Birds of Alaska books say they winter in the ocean, and then they come back when the ice goes out. Are we going to see a reduction in our local loon population in South Central?
Well, it's anybody's guess, I'd say. Bruce, you want to weigh in on that at all?
I don't know. The birds that are being that are mostly washing up on the beach are MERS, but there's almost 2 million MERS in the state, and there's not that many loons. So the loon, there might be a few dead loons mixed in with the MERS. They're both deep diving birds. They might be coming. They might have the same problem.
Yeah. This is the deal. Probably that if it has occurred, we don't know yet. Stu.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking frontier science related to Arctic science, climate change. The Marine Science Symposium is going on in Anchorage, and I pulled in two people from that to speak with the statewide public radio audience and kind of share some of the information from that amazing scientific event. Carrie joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Carrie.
Hey, my question is related to, are there ways that either university or maybe high school students can be more involved in the studies that you're doing? And I want to thank you for the work that you've done over these past years and just heroic studies in tracking these birds, but in continuing these studies over the long term, ways that people can get involved to continue these studies as it expands our understanding of the birds, the polar bears, climate change. I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you much for that, too. I think all of us are seeing a rise in the involvement. The scientific community is more cognizant these days, I think, of younger people than it's ever been in my memory. George, I'll let you respond then to Carrie.
Oh, well, and one of the things I think is that younger people are going to be dealing with changes that are coming up so that they're getting involved in any sort of climate change, say now, or even being aware. We have a few study plans that have been developed through Friends of Cooper Island and with COSI Alaska and ARCUS about how to teach K-6 students about the ice edge retreat and how it's affecting guillemots. But I think that one of the things that and I, when I talk to Audubon groups, I mention this to people, and I don't know how many people follow up on it, but if you have anything that you can monitor at all on a regular basis and do it easily, not to have to go off to the edge of the earth like I do every summer, but if you have a birdhouse and you can be looking at the date of egg laying, if you can see the number, you can see the first date and last date that you get something at your feeder, and something that you can involve your children in rather easily, and you do that for 4 years, then you have a four-year database. And then if you keep that up, if you start with that when they're 5 years old, by the time they're in high school, they have like a science project that would just be amazing. And given the rate of change we're seeing, it could be a very important science project.
We are seeing at the Marine Science Symposium at least one paper done by a high school student. We're seeing these phenology networks that are going. There's all sorts of scientific crowdsourcing that's going on. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, I believe, is being done almost entirely by amateurs now.
Right.
And on it goes. And also, I would think, probably, George, because your field season is only this summer in Alaska, that you might be available for speaking engagements at schools.
Yes. Volunteering.
Yes.
Yeah. Visiting the website cooperisland.org or emailing me at devokey@cooperisland.org. I love talking to school groups, mainly because I can deal with things at a level that is so easily understood, because it isn't some sort of highly nuanced scientific database. These are birds trying to raise their young. They're now struggling because of climate change. It's something that every grade level can understand rather easily.
1-800-478-8255. Carrie, does that do it for you? Oh, that's it for Carrie, yes. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK is the 800 number to join us on Talk of Alaska. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email as talk@alaskapublic.org. And, it's worth noting, says David, that Canadian fisheries biologists on Vancouver Island were finding last summer that the normal food source for out-migrating smolts was displaced by the pseudonychia, and the salmon were getting less than normal nutrition as a result. The blob likely will have further consequences down the road. Boy, howdy there, David. I really do think so. Well, I wanted to get around to predators, because I think pathogens respond quickly to environmental change. And we're seeing that. We're seeing the different plankton, what are these toxins that the planktons produce? But they're essentially biological defense mechanisms, and they adapt very, very quickly. They have a very quick reproductive turnover, and they take advantage of changed conditions a lot faster than, say, humans do. And the same thing with predators. Predators will adapt rather quickly. And I think we're now seeing it all over the Aleutian chain, you know, kind of your ballpark there, Bruce, right? Wouldn't you say?
So the phytoplankton reproduce at about every day and a half or so.
Yeah.
So that's pretty quick, right? But the top predators, they don't. So they have to come up with different strategies. One of the strategies is the switch prey.
Yeah.
I mean, they do that all the time. So they switch prey or they move. A lot of them are migratory and they move to new areas. The other option is they starve to death. If they can't find a new prey, they can't find prey and they can't move, then they're going to starve.
Yeah. And then the prey, of course, they're going to try to adapt too. So we're seeing, for instance, I noticed there's quite a lot of observation going on about various marine mammals in the shallower waters there. And avoiding killer whales, for instance, by getting into shallow water so the killer whale can't come up from underneath, which is a pretty well-known strategy. The gray whales use it. I guess belugas are using this strategy now. But then I'm kind of wondering about these sharks out in the Aleutians.
So I've been taking observations of great white sharks in Alaska, mostly from fishermen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the incidence of observations of great white sharks seems to be increasing.
Hmm.
Any fisherman that's been out there for 20 years that I've talked to usually has observations of great white sharks. But they're such an elusive species, right? And none of them have been tagged yet. And we haven't found very many areas where they concentrate to any number. They're just really tough to study. Plus, there's no economic value for them. So to get research dollars is really difficult.
And it's not like they do echolocation or put out calls like marine mammals may.
Yeah, they're very secretive.
Yeah,
we studied the salmon sharks that congregate some summers up in Prince William Sound, and they're eating salmon. Usually, salmon sharks key in on eating things like herring, but I think during the summer when there's lots of salmon around, that they'll do what's easiest and prey switch. We satellite tag some of these sharks. And there's a area off the edge of the continental shelf that some of them will return to every year. And it's the same location Kathy Frost had tagged a bunch of seals in Prince William Sound. It's the same location that some of these seals will go out and hang for sometimes 2 or 3 weeks. So there's this hot spot, this patch out there of prey that both sharks and seals.
This is somewhere off of like Montague Island?
It's straight south of Montague Island, out on the edge of the continental shelf.
Hmm.
And it's anybody's guess. My guess is that it's a spawning event for squid.
I'm loving the geography of this show today as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
It is Talk of Alaska, and the subject is basically the Marine Science Symposium and all the science that is going on at this point. And all the change that is going on. It's not just the climate that's changing, but the species, the acidity, one thing changes and then it changes another thing. And when you're a species, when you're a biological creature, you adapt. So we were speaking with George DeBokey of Friends of Cooper Island, observing the same batch of black guillemots and discovering more and more about the environment just by watching the same birds up there every field season and measuring so many different things about them. It's a fascinating situation. And one thing you found out, George, is that probably, first off, these birds are even there probably since the last glacial maximum. That's probably when they started, because it's marginal for their environment.
Yes, that's correct. And they have been adapting to a warmer environment for the last 15,000 years. And what we see now are birds that are able to adapt to that. We obviously have a rate of change now that is faster than in the past. But one of the problems with using any biological species as a monitor is that it will change with time. And I could see an increase in numbers just because there'd be selection for birds that like sculpin and don't. So then numbers would come up.
You would think, because at first you had a huge amount of mortality there because the chicks could not handle this really spiny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And like all it takes are parent birds who say, I can catch the small sculpin so you can swallow it. And then those chicks would survive, come back to breed there. And then I would see numbers increasing. So I would have to be aware of that. And people think there's this balance of nature that things are set in a certain way, even though they know things are constantly evolving. And there are a lot of concerns about seasonal mismatches. Like what happens if a bird comes back from the tropics and finds that its prey base was coming out of the ground a week or two earlier than it has in the past. Well, that's been happening for thousands of years, and it's true that the early bird gets the worm. So there is a selection for those early birds who will then be able to pass on this early migration. So certainly the date of arrival, and it's certainly true on Cooper Island, of black guillemots has changed greatly over the past 40 years, and it's changed in response to the fact that the summer is getting earlier. But they aren't coming in late and saying, gee, how come we're 2 weeks late?
You're not doing genetics on these birds, right?
We are doing genetics
really?
Now. We are. We started a thing with Vicky Friesen, who is a Canadian researcher, and every chick that fledged from the island last year, and there were 90 of them, had a DNA sample taken. We're taking the DNA samples, and we're looking at things like things that you couldn't have thought about in 75, things like fitness. And because we banned all the chicks, we can tell who comes back to breed, so we can actually see lineages that are successful in terms of producing young that then come back to the nest site. So it's a very exciting component.
Let's go to Jamie, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jamie.
Hi. My question and comment would be about the MERS. I don't know if you guys addressed this already in the program.
We did a bit early, yeah.
I have been out on the dog team a lot and not hearing a lot of the news, but I found MERS as far up as Squintna, and then I'm hearing that they're washing up on the beach in Whittier, and some people are saying, oh, it's a die-off. And others are saying, oh, a bunch of MERS got blown off course. And I can't really believe either answer. It seems like the ones that I'm seeing and I saw when they were flying around, like as if they were lost. When they went over my head, I thought it was a bunch of penguins. I thought I was hallucinating.
Yeah.
And because I've never seen them before, I knew they were out of place.
Jamie, we only
there
got a minute.
Hundreds of them flying around, and they just couldn't find a place to go.
Jamie, we only have a minute left, and we did go to this before. I'll let Bruce Wright kind of close out on this. We just have a short time here, though. But they're starving. They're starving. Those birds starved.
They're starving. I don't know if I can explain why they're flying so far inland. Some of them were blown inland by a storm that we had in January, earlier in January, but they're weakened. And a lot of the birds, a lot of the MERS are out of their normal distribution for this time of year, in close to shore, probably trying to find new prey species. And when this storm hit, a lot of those got blown in. I ran a quick transect across the flats on the Glen Highway or the Parks Highway, and there was 12 dead birds and 3 live ones. it was pretty sad.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us. And, Jamie, thanks for that field observation from a dog musher all the way out to Squintna and further north, we might add. That is what happened. And the birds were starving, and it still is a mystery. And Bruce was at a session all morning long yesterday where they were basically scratching their heads about this. George DeVoki did a great job. Thank you so much for being on.
Great, Steve. It's great to be on.
After all these years. Bruce Wright, thanks, as always, for all your guidance and being willing to step forward.
Thanks, Steve. I was happy to be on.
All right. Thank you very much, Josh Edge, and the rest of the crew back there. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com. And by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Your household income and the size of your family might qualify you for savings on your health care costs. You have until Sunday, January 31st, to enroll in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Call 1-844-PLANS-AK. That's 1-844-752-6725 to find local assistance in your area. There's more information online at getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.